I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. The proposed U.S.-China trade deal has become a trade war. President Trump has complained bitterly about the $500 billion trade imbalance between the two countries, imposing tariffs on $250 billion in Chinese products and threatening more tariffs of up to 25% on essentially all Chinese imports, including things like cell phones and sneakers, handbags, sunglasses. China has imposed import penalties on $60 billion in U.S. goods, including soybeans and pork, upsetting American farmers. Trying to allay those fears, Trump tweeted, "Our great Patriot farmers will be one of the big beneficiaries of the trade war." Larry Kudlow, National Economic Council director, speaking on Fox News Sunday, defended tariffs to host Chris Wallace.
It's not China that pays tariffs. It's the American importers, the American companies that pay what in effect is a tax increase and oftentimes passes it on to U.S. consumers.
Fair enough. In fact, both sides will pay. Both sides will pay in these things. And, of course, it depends.
If it's a tariff on goods coming into the country, the Chinese aren't paying.
No, but the Chinese will suffer GDP losses and so forth with respect to a diminishing export market and goods that they may need for their own
I understand that, but
economy.
The president says China pays the tariffs. They may suffer consequences, but it's U.S. businesses and U.S. consumers who pay, correct?
Yes, to some extent. I don't disagree with that. Again, both sides will suffer on this.
President Trump said he would meet with Chinese President Xi at the G20 in late June. Well, today on Radio Times, what does this trade war mean for consumers and farmers, businesses, and the global economy? We have two guests who have joined us. Rana Farooqar is global business columnist and an associate editor at the Financial Times. She's based in New York. She's also CNN's global economic analyst. She was a guest on Radio Times when her book, Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business, was published. Rana Farooqar, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Jared Bernstein, and he's senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to then Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. Jared Bernstein joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
My pleasure.
Well, let's begin with Chris Wallace, and I'll put this to you, Rana Farooqar. Is he right, which is that the American taxpayer, the American consumer, will pay the tariff?
Yeah, for sure, and particularly this time around. You know, the last time we had some lower tariffs put onto Chinese goods, businesses mostly ate that. You know, they took the pain themselves. They narrowed their profit margins. This time around, it's going to be much, much tougher for businesses to really absorb the entire hit. For starters, it's a greater tariff, but secondly, it's on a broader range of goods. So you've got everything from furniture to clothing to electronics parts to all kinds of materials that are really going to be spread in terms of the pain that's going to be felt. It's going to be spread throughout the American population. You know, by some calculations, American families will pay $800 or more a year extra if nothing changes in the tariff pictures.
To you, Jared Bernstein, are we then in the middle or the beginning of a trade war? Is this what a trade war looks like?
This is precisely what a trade war looks like, precisely this type of escalation. By the way, I just want to put a little asterisk or note here. I thought it was just a sign of the times that it became big news because someone in the Trump administration told the truth about something. This is something we all knew.
Well,
this.
Well, we like the truth. You know,
we
like to talk about the truth.
I'm not criticizing anyone who's elevating this incident of truth-telling, but I just think it's weird that it and I give Kudlow credit, but I just think it's strange that he said something everybody knows. It's kind of the emperor has no clothes, and everyone was, like, clapping their hands. But, this is what a trade war looks like. This is precisely the kind of escalation that many of us worried about when this thing began back in 2018.
Well, but I think what's newsworthy, just to defend the clip that we played, is that he, meaning Larry Kudlow, really contradicted President Trump.
Agree. No, I agree with you. We're in this weird kind of world where President Trump says falsehoods. Somebody on his staff, I think maybe courageously, tells the truth. And it's news.
Go ahead, Rana.
Well, I also think I think it's also interesting because I think it illustrates the divide within the administration itself about what the conflict with China means. I mean, I think, you know, I suspect that people like Kudlow, who are more sort of traditional trickle-down conservatives, are a bit more worried about the price that consumers and businesses are going to pay. There are hawks within the administration that see this really as something beyond a trade war, really a cold war, a more of an existential divide between China and the U.S. and the launch of a conflict that is much bigger and broader and more strategic. And I think that they're less worried about the pain that certainly the businesses are going to suffer. It's interesting. I've spoken to some of those folks that believe that U.S. businesses that are outsourcing to China are kind of economic traitors. So there's a real divide in the White House on what all this means, I think.
Jared, I did notice that early on, Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, who's a Democrat, obviously, was in favor of what the president at least was proposing not so long ago.
So I've known and interacted with Senator Schumer for a long time, and he has been a China hawk ever since he's been in politics. So that's not been a surprise. However, this morning, I read in the paper that he's kind of backing off. Huh. and suggesting that while he definitely supports the goal of trying to force China to play fair in terms of the rules of international trade, he argues that the Trump administration is going about it the wrong way. Now, I will say, and this gets back to what I think were a set of wise comments from Rana just a second ago, I will say that the theory of the case for the administration's trade negotiators is that no one has pushed China as hard and as far as they have because no one's played this kind of hardball with them, and that's the only way to get the Chinese to move. And there's something to that. I will say everybody who keeps saying, and I'm probably guilty of this as well, everyone who keeps saying, Trump, I get that you want to get China to play fair, but you're going about the wrong way. Nobody really has a lot to say about what the right way is.
Right.
Well, do you have a right way, Jared?
Well, I want to be fair to the critics. There is one right way that they talk about, and I think it's really true, which is... There needs to be a coalition of the willing among us and our trading partners, all standing up to China together, kind of holding hands and telling them the way we want it to be. But that doesn't work if you're slapping tariffs on your friends in Canada and Europe. So I do think that is one way to go about it.
Ron, is it also a problem in that this is a bilateral negotiation or a bilateral deal, does not include other countries?
Yeah, no, I would completely agree with what Jared just said. I mean, one of I would argue the biggest strategic mistake that the Trump administration made in taking on China in the way that they have is by not getting Europe on board, and in particular by not getting the Germans on board. I mean, the truth is that a lot of the basic beefs that this administration has with China, not all of them, but many of them, are complaints that other administrations have had, that the Obama administration has had, many other administrations in the past. And there are also complaints that Europeans have. You know, they want to know that their IP is going to be protected. They want to have an equal playing field around how business is done globally. And by alienating Europe and also by trying to wreck NAFTA at the same time, That the administration was taking on China, they really bit off more than they can chew, I think. There's another point, too, though, which is that part of the reset of the American economy that needs to happen is about what's happening abroad and the relationship with our trading partners, but a lot more of it is about how you build a robust ecosystem at home. And if there's any lessons to take from the Chinese, is that they do a really good job at that. And we should actually take more lessons on that front from the Chinese.
Jared, I was reading about something called Chimerica, which is the amount of, I guess, Chinese and American either companies or businesses that, in a sense, work together or are sort of part of this larger economic merger that's been, I guess, what, happening around the world?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think one of the fundamental flaws in Trumpian trade policy is kind of this idea that you can unscramble the globalization omelet. What's actually going on here at a pretty simple level, in my view, is a fight between two very big and powerful I'm talking about President Xi and President Trump, two powerful leaders who both are protectionist and both are what's called mercantilist. And mercantilism is this idea that you grow your economy by blocking imports and promoting exports. Okay, so you sell to the rest of the world, but you block imports that are coming into you. Well, that's not really a very realistic thing. And I think probably the best way to underscore that point is Trump keeps talking about his goal being, he doesn't use these words, but import substitution. That means instead of buying stuff from abroad, he wants us to make it here. Well, because the globalization omelet has been cooked up, and I don't want to push this metaphor too far, has been cooked up and eaten by all the diners, that's just not going to happen, certainly not in any near term. And frankly, we wouldn't want it to happen. Trade flows are not only good for our economy, but they're good for the global economy.
Well, I wonder, Ron, go ahead.
I'll actually, Jared and I agree on most things, but I'll push back a little bit there. I actually think that we are headed for more of a bipolar or even a tripolar world in which the U.S., possibly Latin America, depending on how relations go on that front and who wins the 2020 election, are sort of one block. Europe is another block. China and Asia and the emerging markets are a third block. And I'll tell you why, because if you look at trade patterns, trade in traditional goods and services, you know, all the things we hear about, soybeans, steel, that's been flat or falling for a number of years, even before the Trump administration came into office. What's growing? Digital trade. That's up about 45 times in the last 10 years. Now, look at the issues in the digital economy and in internet governance. I mean, China has a surveillance state. Europe wants very tough privacy rules. The U.S. is trying to figure out how big companies like Facebook and Google and Amazon are going to be regulated. There are real ethical, existential divides right now in terms of governance of the digital economy. And I think we are going to see more splintering. And I actually think that global CEOs, and in particular American CEOs, have really had blinkers on about the fact that I don't think you're going to see a wholesale turn back of globalization, but I think you can see more splintering than we might have expected.
Ron, we're almost having a break here, but where does that leave, let's say, soybean farmers? And I've heard a number of interviews of them complaining bitterly about the fact that they're going to be hit hard.
For sure. I mean, I think it's very interesting. You've seen Democrats really campaigning hard in some of those red state areas and places like Iowa, talking to farmers and really trying to make hay with the fact that they are going to be hit hardest by the Trump policies. If you look at the 10 states that would be hit hardest by a trade war, 8 of them voted for Trump. So stakes are very high. Now, I will say very quickly, though, that I do talk to a lot of farmers that say, you know what? It's been painful, but we're still with him because he's pointing out the hypocrisies of the global system. How far that can go when you start to see even more trouble in farm states, it'll be interesting to see.
And that's Rana Faruhar. She joined us along with Jared Bernstein. We're talking about the declared trade war between the U.S. and China, how it will impact consumers here in this country, also people like farmers in this country. It will have and is having some global implications as well. You can join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone. We're talking about the trade war between the United States and China, its impact on consumers, farmers, companies, the country's economy, the global economy. And again, our guests are Rana Faruhar, global business columnist at the Financial Times, and Jared Bernstein. He's senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Let me play two clips from President Trump. He was speaking yesterday outside the White House about his decision to impose tariffs on Chinese goods.
We're having a little squabble with China because we've been treated very unfairly for many, many decades, for actually a long time. And it should have been handled a long time ago, and it wasn't, and we'll handle it now. I think it's going to turn out extremely well. We're in a very strong position. We are the piggy bank that everybody likes to take advantage of or take from, and we can't let that happen anymore. We've been losing for many years anywhere from $300 billion to $500 billion a year with China and trade with China. We can't let that happen.
He also went on to say the U.S. will make over $100 billion, saying the effect of the tariff could mean manufacturers will make their products in the United States.
We're going to be collecting over $100 billion in tariffs. Our people, if they want, they could buy from someplace else other than China, or they can really, the ideal is make their product in the USA. That's what I really want. Yeah, we're winning it. You know what? You want to know something? You want to know something? We always win. We always win.
Jared, let me turn to you, and I'm sure, Ronnie, you want to weigh in on this as well. First of all, Trump has been quoted as saying trade wars are good and easy to win. Jared, is that true?
No, I don't think history would support that at all. In fact, I recently wrote a piece where, as part of the effort, I actually went back and read as much history as I could of this very question. Interestingly, the problem with trade wars turns out to be largely a geopolitical one. We've been talking about trade flows and inflation and consumers and businesses, and yes, sure, they definitely get dinged along the way. But you know, people have connected, historians have connected the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the 1930s to the rise of fascism. Historians will tell you the only winners in a trade war are the countries who sit out. So I'm really worried about the geopolitical dynamics of this as it keeps going. I understand Rana's point that trade flows are topped out and they're going to decline. I'm very skeptical. We can't predict the trade deficit next month, much less weeks, I mean, quarters or years in advance. I think that global trade flows will continue to be very important to economies across the globe unless we deeply screw them up, which is what we're doing with this trade war. And the consequences of that isn't just going to be the kinds of trade deficit issues that Trump was talking about. It could be a realignment of geopolitics in a way that it's very hard to foresee.
Well, Ronna, let me turn to you. I'm just curious about just picking up what Jared said, but also what the president has said as well. And he seems to say, well, just buy from another country. That would be a message to some of the companies that have businesses in China itself, but also saying to Americans, well, buy American. Is that possible? Can you buy a refrigerator that you can afford in America, made in America?
Refrigerator, not sure. But, you know, the point of how supply chains are going to flow, has globalization gone too far? Do we need a little more localization? I mean, I frankly think these are legitimate questions. Now, I think the Trump administration has no 360 plan for how to deal with resetting the American economy. I mean, that's kind of part of the problem here is the president's very good at disrupting things. He's not good at the next stage, which is, you know, all right, let's say you want to encourage some reshoring or you want to encourage some more localized supply chains. How do you go about that? Well, the first thing you have to do is kind of look at your own economic picture, look at where strengths and weaknesses are in different geographic regions, connect the dots between educators and job creators. These are not sexy things. They're long, hard problems. They're certainly not anything that the president it's going to tackle. But I want to go to this question of geopolitics and economics. They're actually very intricately related at this moment. And let me give you an example. And I think that this is complicated but very telling. Look at the wars over 5G. You know, 5G is the new high-speed telecom service that's going to be rolling out globally. There are two big chip makers that make the chips for 5G smartphones. One is Qualcomm, which is an American company. The other is Huawei, which is a Chinese company. Now, until recently, Qualcomm was in a three-continental, long, multi-year legal battle with Apple, and so it was really kind of hamstrung. It's been a political hot potato for the Trump administration. There was a Singaporean company that wanted to acquire it. That was scuppered by the administration on grounds of national security. So in the U.S., you have companies that are trying to deal with both politics and the realities of a global market system. In China, you have companies that are, frankly, they can take the long term. They don't have the quarterly pressures of the market. They're supported by the state. And so Qualcomm makes chips that are actually pretty good and, at this point, a lot cheaper. Huawei makes chips that are pretty good and a lot cheaper than Qualcomm. So that then begs the question, well, when Europe rolls out its own 5G systems, is it going to buy Huawei chips? I think it may. At the same time, you've got China making real geopolitical overtures to Europe via its One Belt, One Road strategy of kind of linking up the old Silk Road into the southern parts of Europe. These are economic and geopolitical questions. And the fact that the Trump administration has really just abdicated from the global stage doesn't help the U.S. on any of these fronts.
Let me read a tweet from Margo. I'll put this to you, Jared. She says, what is nuts is that we have shifted production of so much to China that we no longer produce stuff that we can now buy, that we now buy from China. But is that the world that we live in through globalization?
Yes and no. I mean, I think the tweeter has if that's what you call them.
I think so.
Has a point. I am skeptical of Trump's idea. I called it import substitution earlier, that we could build factories in sort of a handy way that would replace many of the goods that we import from abroad. And I actually think that in many cases that'd be disadvantageous to our economy. The trade flows that exist have been, I think, pretty integral to much of our development and that of other countries throughout the economy. What I think we could do a lot more of, and here is where I think the administration gets it wrong, so I'm sort of getting back to my earlier point. Everybody tells them they get it wrong, but nobody says what they should be doing. So let me talk a little bit about that.
Sure.
I think that we could help many of our manufacturers and even our service exporters, which is, by the way, we have a trade surplus in services, whether it's tourism or financial services or entertainment. We could help many of our smaller entrepreneurs and producers in those sectors connect with global supply chains. So it's sort of like I heard a politician recently say something that kind of resonated with me: protection, not protectionism. Instead of building walls and barriers and tariffs, we actually should help companies, especially smaller ones, that don't have necessarily the wherewithal, the means, the resources to connect with global supply chains to do so. To me, that's the right way to go. And in fact, there is some offices within the government that try to do that. There's something in the Commerce Department called the Manufacturing Extension Partnership that is designed to help small manufacturers, among other things, connect with global supply chains. But of course, the Trump administration has been whacking the heck out of their budget, or trying to do so, and that's exactly the wrong move. So I guess I'd rather be a smart player in the globalization sandbox, accomplish some of what this Twitter note suggests, which is to build up American production and exports play less of a blocking game.
Rana, let me ask you about China, how you think this trade war will affect China. And it does have a growing middle class and obviously a market for not just American companies, but companies from around the world. How do you see China being impacted by this trade war?
Right. So I think that there's going to be a lot of short-term pain. China is trying to make a big leap. It's trying to go from being at the tail end of kind of a middle class. I mean, it's still pretty largely a pretty poor country, but it's trying to make this kind of middle market jump to being a more affluent nation. Only three, maybe four Asian countries have ever done that: Japan, South Korea, Singapore and Taiwan. And China is a much bigger population. So this is a really tough leap to make. Now, in order to make that, it needs to transition from being the factory of the world, which is what it's been, you know, a supplier of cheap parts and goods to the rest of the world, to being a big consumer market. Now, it was always going to make that leap, but the pressure from the trade war is going to make it is going to create a push to make that leap faster. Now, can it make that without creating social unrest? That's the big question. I'm actually feeling pretty bullish that the Chinese can do that. And I'll tell you, I think that the fact that they can take a long-term view and just simply have a commitment to where they're going in the next 5, 10, 15 years, it is an advantage. I mean, there are many, many disadvantages of autocracy. None of us would want to, I think, you know, that are Americans would want to live in an autocracy. But,
sure.
You know, 5-year, 10-year, 20-year planning helps China. And the other thing to remember, and I think Americans don't sometimes land on this, China is kind of like America post-World War II. It's a very large, single language market with a lot of room to grow. And, you know, they've got their own products that can compete with American products. If you look at a company like Xiaomi, for example, which is a big smartphone maker in China, they sell more smartphones than Apple does. So the Chinese are actually in some ways better placed longer term to deal with more of a regionalization or a pullback from globalization, because they can sort of ring fence the entire landscape themselves, create their own supply chains and sell to their own people.
That's Rana Faruhar, global business columnist, associate editor at the Financial Times. She's also CNN's global economic analyst, joining us along with Jared Bernstein, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, talking about the trade war between the United States and China. And again, you can join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jared, Terry says, I saw on Market Watch yesterday that Trump's 2020 campaign banners are being manufactured in China. I mean, I think it just shows how interconnected the world is, I guess, both politically and financially.
Yeah, I mean, Terry's correct to point that out. I remember that the little flags, little American flags that the Trump campaign produced were also made in China. And Trump himself
ties
in many of
well.
His... In many of his businesses, has hired immigrants from across the globe. So there is definitely a great deal of hypocrisy here. But the bigger point is again this globalization omelet. We are very much integrated in this regard, and I think there is a fair question as to how can we help our manufacturers, communities that have lost significant employment. There are people and places that have really been hurt by globalization. I think Rana would probably agree with this, that globalization has been a net plus for the U.S. But that doesn't mean that nobody's been hurt by it. And in fact, it's one of the reasons that Trump is president, because I think there were many politicians on both sides who kind of really just whistled past that problem and offered these people that I'm talking about who've been hurt by expanded trade, basically another new trade deal that was going to be better than the last one. Well, Trump came along and said, that's all nonsense, and I'm really going to help you. Well, not only has he not helped you, he's now actively hurting you with his tariffs. He's also massively redistributed income to those at the top of the income scale through his tax cuts. So he is not helping the people who've been hurt. But I think one of the real prices to entry, at least from my perspective, for those who would like to be president, and there are dozens of them now on the Democratic side, is explaining how will you truly help people who have been hurt by exposure to global trade and the large imbalances that we've had in our country. Not the kind of Trumpian rhetoric that will always win because we're so great. I think that's finally I hope that's finally falling on ears that are much more savvy to what to the snake oil he's selling. But no, I haven't really heard enough people come forth and say what they would do to actually address
that
problem. Go ahead, Rana.
That's a good point, actually. The Democrats really need to hone their trade message. Trump's great, one small, great, but great genius was in exposing the hypocrisy of the last 40 years of status quo globalization. I mean, he didn't say how he would solve it, and in many cases, he's made it worse or actually kind of forwarded the same policies, even as he's, giving us the Make America Great Again rhetoric. But like any great con man, there's often a nugget of truth embedded in a welter of lies. And the truth was, a lot of people have been hurt by globalization. Not if you look globally, there are more people that have been brought out of poverty than ever before. But if you look within countries, inequality has risen, and there have been small points of very concentrated pain, the Rust Belt, certain southern states. This is what he played up. Now, how do you fix that? I'm a little worried because I don't see the Democrats with a strong message around that. I see them with a strong message around other important issues like corporate monopoly power, inequality, but they've got to get that message on trade. And I think that there are ways to do that. I mean, I actually think something like the Green New Deal, for example, is really ripe to pull together some of the threads that we've been talking about. Europe is profoundly concerned about climate change. Countries like Germany have really interesting initiatives around encouraging green industries. I mean, there's a lot that we could connect to globally there. And at the same time, you could imagine creating local economies that would be more robust. You could have, say, union workers retrofitting houses with green technologies. I mean, there are policy solutions out there. We just need to think about them and talk about them.
Let me just make sure we all understand. I'll go back to you, Jared. Then are you both saying that tariffs will not help people who have been hurt in this country by globalization?
No, I don't believe they will. I understand the Trump theory of the case is that you got to take some pain to get some gain. But at the end of the day, I don't think we're tackling the kinds of policy solutions that would truly help folks, which are, and I agree with Rana, there's an investment agenda there, an investment in green energy is part of it. Just to drill down a little bit, be a bit more granular about that. One of the things that China did smartly is decades ago, they looked at the world and they essentially said, somebody is going to dominate market share when it comes to consumer electronics, and they decided it would be them. And they made the investments, and they certainly dominate in that regard. Now, that tends to be at least their part of the chain, tends to be fairly low value added, so I'm not saying we'd want to take that back. We need to do exactly the same thing, and I think the area of green technology is the place to go. Look around the next corner and try to figure out where are the market share opportunities, not in low value add consumer electronics, but in something like battery storage, solar production, other elements of the green of the green agenda, because somebody out there is going to dominate the global market when it comes to, say, producing batteries that can store power. And that race is on. And because we're so distracted with all of this Trumpian nonsense and tariffs, we're not even in that race yet. And that's a mistake.
Well, you know what? Hold on, only because we have to take a very short break. And I appreciate both of you being so enthusiastic talking about this really important topic, but can get wonky from time to time, talking about the trade war between the United States and China. Jared Bernstein and Rana Furuhar are our guests. We've got some folks that want to join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jared Bernstein. He's senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. And Rana Furuhar, she's joining us by telephone, and she's global business columnist and an associate editor at the Financial Times. Rana, you wanted to say something then? I've got a bunch of comments here I do want to get to, but go ahead.
Well, you know, I wanted to make a broader point, which is that the tariff issue in some way touches a bigger issue, which is the fact that over the last 40 or 50 years, we've had an economy that was predicated on the welfare of consumers, right? You know, thinking about how can we make things cheaper? How can we boost the stock market? I think that the underlying issue, the more fundamental issue that we're trying to think about right now, and this is on both sides of the political aisle, is maybe we should have a worker-led economy. You know, maybe we should have an economy that was really more about putting a little more income in people's wallets. Because if you think about it, if you live in a country like the U.S., the 60-70% consumer spending-led, if nobody's gotten a raise in 20 years, the math kind of stops working. And you know, the fact that the stock market is being juiced by low rates, a lot of corporate debt, that's a false sugar high. You know, nothing on the Main Street story has changed. And I think that tariffs are really just the first step in this broader question of, do you want a consumer economy or do you want a worker-led economy?
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, Jared, it is also interesting that the stock market just took a giant tumble on Monday yesterday, kind of righted itself. Should we care what the stock market is doing in response to tariffs and a trade war?
Broadly speaking, certainly not day to day. I mean, the stock market these days tends to be like a very severe manic depressive who kind of goes up and down.
Taking its temperature all the time, right?
Yeah, massive overreactions. That said, there are obviously lots of people whose portfolios and in many cases retirement income is there. So you want to look at it over the long term. I mean, over the long term, the stock market's been, I say medium term, it's been doing really well because because American corporate profitability is strong. And you kind of have to link that to Rana's comments that corporate profitability strong, paychecks, you know, not so much. Recently, a little better, and that's good. But I do think that for years, and this has been an old rap of mine, this is the thing Rana was just saying, for years, economists, especially in the trade space, have looked at citizens, at people in their countries, as consumers, not workers. So if they could lower the prices that those consumers faced, it was a big win. What they never connected enough, in my view, was the connection between prices and wages and the dampening effect of not really just globalization in general, but persistent large trade deficits on folks who compete with imports or try to export. And that is a real problem. It's one we've been talking about. And sure, I think we have to wrap our heads around the fact that people aren't just consumers. They're also workers, they're family members, they're community members. We really have to expand our scope on this.
Let me take a comment from Theodore. Ron, I'll put this to you. Theodore says Trump never said this wasn't going to be cost in the beginning, but that's okay. America can handle itself in the global market. Do you share his optimism?
I think that America is lucky in that it is a big geography with food, fuel, and consumer demand at home. That I think is true. We would do better in a trade war than, say, the UK would, for example. But yeah, there is going to be a tremendous amount of short-term pain. And the problem is that I think that American businesses, I mean, forget about the administration, American businesses really haven't gotten their brains around what a paradigm shift would look like. I mean, I'll be honest, I've been wondering for years why businesses didn't factor in the political risk of large complex supply chains more than they have. And I'll give you an example. I mean, I don't know if you remember a few years back when there was a collapse of a big factory in Bangladesh, the Rana Plaza factory. It killed about 2,000 people. Wow. And it turned out that it was doing business as the end of a very complex supply chain for big companies like Walmart and H&M. That came with big risk for them, political risk, reputational risk. I think that those things don't get factored onto the balance sheet so easily, and I think companies are just at a tipping point where they're starting to think, okay, you know, getting things to the cheapest place in these complex supply chains may look good on paper, but what are the real costs? And I think that that's part of this discussion.
Hey, Marty, can I?
Yeah, go ahead, Jared. Sure.
Very quick. I actually think from the perspective of the macro economy, the big U.S. economy, if this thing should end in late June, where Xi and Trump are going to meet at an economic forum, I don't think there will be tremendous short-term pain to the overall economy. And if you look at economists' estimates for what they're worth, under that scenario, inflation maybe gets bumped up by 0.2%. Maybe we shave a quarter or a half a point off GDP growth. That is not nothing, but it's not tremendous short-term pain. I think the real short-term pain is very specific to the folks who are hurt by the tariffs. So if you're a farmer trying to export soybeans, or if you're a bicycle shop who's using intermediate goods from other countries importing steel, you're going to feel it. But I think we have to be a little careful not to suggest that the trade war is going to tank the U.S. economy, because then when it doesn't, we're gonna look like we were crying wolf.
But Jared, if in a year from now the trade war is still on, and I'm talking to you and Rana Faruhar, is that a bigger problem?
That's a much bigger problem. And so, I was stipulating, and I've heard a lot of people suggest that perhaps this could end at the end of June when the two presidents meet. Those people don't know. None of us know what these two, especially one, very volatile leaders will agree or not agree. And so, yes, if it deepens, if it gets worse, if Trump throws tariffs on the other $300 billion of imported Chinese goods, then I'm looking for real macroeconomic pain. And even possibly if it gets bad enough, it could be recessionary.
Here's an email from Anne. I'll put this to you, Rana. She says, I'm wondering whether it's a possibility that in the escalation of this trade war, China will decide to call in our debts. How much of the national debt does China owe? And it should be said that they owe a lot. Is that something to worry about?
You know, much less than you would think. I mean, the truth is that China has been selling T-bills and moving into other currencies for a number of years now. They own less American debt than they used to a few years back. It hasn't really tanked the market. And P.S., if China were to try and sell whatever remaining treasury bills it did have, it would hurt their economy more than ours. I actually think that that's one risk, this idea of a currency war that has been really overplayed. I don't see that happening. I see this as more of a slow and steady progression, kind of as Jared was suggesting, that won't be over in June, that won't be over a year from now, but I believe is really a kind of a 10, 20, 30-year process of rebalancing the global economy. The Chinese are going in a very different direction with their own system and their own agenda than the U.S. is. I think we have one world and we have two systems, and we're all going to have to adjust to that.
But I wonder, Rana, whether trade policies have the effect of bringing democracy or more openness to a country like China. Does it work that way?
That was what we thought.
Well,
that was the big, as they get richer, they're going to be more like us.
Yep.
Wrong. I mean, for starters, it's so arrogant. Like, let's be honest. The idea that this 5,000-year-old civilization should want to be just like America, like what? You know, how did we come to that? That idea, I certainly wouldn't want to live in an autocracy, but the Chinese see things differently than we do. This is not a justification of the point of view, but let me put it to you. Let me turn the lens and tell you how China sees things. China says to themselves, we've lifted 500 million people out of poverty in the last couple of decades. We're willing to take some rollback of civil liberties for that. Now, I have a hard time with that as an American. I have a very hard time with the fact that the Uyghurs are being persecuted. I have a hard time with the fact that there's been a crackdown on journalists in China. But the Chinese themselves have a different lens, and we need to remember that.
Here's an email from Sarah, Jared. She asked, do your guests feel that Trump has a coherent plan for dealing with China and trade, or is this just tit-for-tat bullying? How do you see it? Is there a plan?
I don't think so.
I'm asking Jared, but I'll ask you after that, Rana.
Sure.
Go ahead, Jared.
I don't think there is much of a it's a good question. I don't think there's much of a coherent plan. I mean, I think that the trade negotiators, and Robert Lighthizer is our lead trade negotiator, and he's been involved in this world for decades, and he knows what he's doing. His theory of the case is that if we really hit the Chinese hard, such that we generate enough economic kind of suffering over there, that they'll pull back on these trade practices that are widely agreed to be unfair. So subsidizing state industry, procuring intellectual property from these joint venture agreements when multinational firms go to China, they say you have to give us your, intellectual property, stuff like that. And, that's the theory of the case. Their argument is that no other American president or trade negotiation regime has pushed as hard as they are. And, they really have a point. No one has. I don't think at the end of the day that they're going to succeed with that. The Chinese have historically said, shake hands, we'll do what you say, and they've gone back and done what they wanted. And in fact, that's why these last round of negotiations broke down, because the American negotiators thought that they had an agreement by the Chinese to actually legislate enforceable standards so that they could make sure that these reforms were taking place. The Chinese said, we're not going to change our laws for you. So I think that you're just seeing two very protectionist, mercantilist leaders butt heads here, and I'm somewhat pessimistic about the outcome because I don't really see it as coherent.
Here's an email from Eric saying, shipping ordinary goods halfway around the world is a fundamentally flawed and destructive model that only flourishes because it's the easiest way to hide the true cost of exploitive business. And it is, when you do think about it, Ron, many things, of course, are shipped from one country to the other, but it does seem like a rather expensive way of doing business.
It does, and there are also hidden risks, as I illustrated. I really do think that with or without this trade war, we were probably the pendulum of globalization has shifted really far in one direction. And there are a lot of economists and experts, Raghu Rajan from the University of Chicago being one of them, who wrote a book recently saying, you know what, if we want to save globalization, maybe we need a little bit less of it. Maybe we need a little more focus on in-country development, on making sure that there aren't such wide divides within all countries, not just the U.S. And I think localization is part of that. And by the way, there are also a number of real business trends that support this. You know, people want things more quickly. They want just-in-time production. They want customized goods. That all kind of argues for a certain amount of localization. Not a huge dramatic shift. It's not like we're suddenly going to produce everything in the U.S., but I think some tweaks around the edges were coming, irregardless of what was happening with trade.
Jared, we obviously have a trade deficit with China. At what point does that become a problem, or is it a problem as it exists today?
I don't think you could say it's a problem as it exists today, because if you look at our economic indicators, they're quite strong. GDP growth is solid, the unemployment rate at a 50-year low, so it's hard to point at the trade deficit as a big drag to the overall economy. However, the trade deficit represents very plainly things that we're buying from abroad that in many cases used to be made here. So a large persistent trade deficit like that is one of the reasons that there are many communities, particularly in the Rust Belt, that have been hurt by globalization. So I don't think you can look at it as a macroeconomic drag, but I think you can certainly point to places where it hurts a lot. And at periods where the economy is weaker, unlike now, you know, the trade deficit has been a real problem.
Ron, go ahead, Jared.
I just want to quickly make a point about the trade flows, the last question, and Rana's point about more local production. I think that's all well and good. I guess one reason why I've always been an admirer of trade between countries, this is sort of maybe against what the last caller was saying, is that it's not just about the American economy. I actually want the Bangladeshian economy also to have a chance to evolve, the Vietnamese economy. And this is why, by the way, I'm not running for office, because you can't say that stuff and never get elected. But one of the reasons
it's
why...
It's official, folks. Yeah, go ahead, Jared.
I'm not announcing today. One of the reasons why I think trade flows are an advance for the globe is that just like we, in our industrialization history, were able to sell into the globe and increase our living standards, I think emerging countries ought to have the same chance.
Well, Ron, are you a globalist as well? And we have just about
45 seconds. I work for the Financial Times, which is a global. I'm certainly, as someone that has worked and lived around the world, and I agree, of course, with what Jared's saying. But, you know, I also think that we've forgotten in recent years that place matters. You know, a lot of us that are on airplanes, you know, for much of our careers and fly kind of 35,000 feet over the problems of whichever nation state we're in, have a lot of luxuries to speak about these things in technocratic ways. But when you go to some of these communities and you really see how things are happening on the ground, you have a different perspective, and both perspectives are important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate both of you joining us today on Radio Times. We were scurrying yesterday afternoon to book the show. Rana Farouhar, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And she's a global business columnist and an associate editor at the Financial Times, also CNN's global economic analyst. In her book, Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business, I believe out in paperback. Jared Bernstein, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
And he's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, also executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class and a member of President Obama's economic team. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.